entrepreneurship, committed to expanding human welfare through economic growth, on the web at kauffman.org.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. WILL programs are made possible in part by Bevere Cafe, offering breakfast from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. and lunches from 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. Monday through Friday, and catering. Bevere Cafe is student-operated on the second floor of Bevere Hall, corner of Gregory and Goodwin, Urbana.
It's 106. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. I'm Tom Rogers. Henry Frain is our technical director. And we have on our show today part of a fairly regular series of conversations, not maybe once or twice a year, but we will bring in the Dean of the College of Media here at the University of Illinois, Ron Yates, and talk about issues facing journalists and journalism and the media in general. And we figured since we can't avoid the subject of the election and haven't been able to for the last couple of years, in fact, with the presidential race, to talk about how the media is covering the election and the campaigns and whether that coverage is balanced and fair in the eyes of people. Ron, yeah, thanks again for joining us on the Afternoon Magazine today, and we step into the minefield as this is a subject that almost anybody does, everybody has an opinion on.
Go carefully with a mine detector.
That's right. But we invite your calls to talk about the media in this campaign season and your opinions, your comments, your questions on how reporters do their jobs and editors do their jobs and publishers and editors and station managers and the like as the election season winds up into its climax in early November. Our phone numbers to join in the conversation are 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana and outside the local calling area 1-800-222-9455. And I guess when we try to measure and monitor balance and fairness, we have to put some definitions on those two words, and that's a tough thing to pin down.
It is, because fairness and balance are often in the eyes of the beholder, reader, viewer, listener, and no matter how hard you try to achieve this balance, it's going to be perceived one way or the other by whoever you're targeting your message to. And I think I think one of the things that people need to understand when we talk about those topics is that the media, people like to talk about the media as some huge, enormous, great creature with a single mind, and really the media are not that. This creature that we like to call the media doesn't make these comprehensive, concurrent kinds of decisions about anything. There's no sum of its many parts. So we've got to stop talking about it as some giant transformer that brings its disparate parts together in a great room and then decides how it will cover the news, the candidates, the campaign on any given day. It just doesn't work that way.
It's kind of entertaining to see the media as a big transformer.
But, right. I mean, you can kind of envision it, the New York Times over here and the Chicago Tribune.
All coming into one big superhero.
But, you know, having said that, there's no doubt that political reporters during a presidential campaign, they move in packs. And so we get to the issue of fairness and balance. What happens often, reporters, I think, one of the problems today with political coverage is they spend too much time hanging out with one another. And when you do that, you fall into the trap of what we call pack journalism. And what happens often is reporters, like anybody else, they compare notes. They talk about different candidates. Gee, what's it like covering John McCain? What's it like covering Sarah Palin? What's it like covering Biden or Barack Obama? And they all compare these notes, and they often wind up rooting for the candidate that's the most fun to cover.
Well, and you have that pitfall that, you know, all these people are on the plane following these candidates around in a plane often paid for by the candidate.
Right. And each of the candidates, Barack Obama and McCain, have these pool, what they call it's like a protective pool, they call them. And within each pool, you have I believe, a wire service reporter, a photographer, somebody from the print media, and then they rotate all the networks plus the cable channels, one reporter a week coming in with their crews. So those people are always with that same candidate all the time. And that allows the candidates then to have more of an influence, I believe, on the reporters. But it also means that the reporters have to be a lot more circumspect, a lot more aggressive about their coverage. They cannot allow themselves to be sort of seduced into this world of, well, I really like this guy or I like this woman because she's really nice and she talks a lot or whatever. You know, you've got to be very careful how you proceed.
Have those media outlets tried to respond to that by maybe bicycling their correspondence from candidate to candidate? Because you have pluses and minuses. You get to know that candidate and their campaign and their talking points and what's different, what's new. You've got the, you know, the background, the experience that, that you can draw upon when you're writing. But on the other hand, you've got that worry that you're talking about.
Right. They do rotate them through. I'm almost positive. I know we did at the Tribune when we were covering, when I was an editor there, you have to do that because I believe you become too immersed in one. And it's really good to have your best reporters move between the candidates, you know, either or actually move, you know, you may have reporters covering the two presidential candidates. They move back and forth and they're able to compare notes and able to make some judgments based on what they've heard the candidates say. The problem with covering candidates today is because, first of all, there's so much going on and there are so many appearances that are made. You're a reporter, you're covering McCain or you're covering Obama, and you're watching them give these same speeches, essentially, over and over and over and over and over again.
It never changes.
Right, it never changes. They may change. Okay, we're in Ohio, so I have to make sure I say something about Ohio. Okay, we're in Florida, I got to say something about Florida. They make these changes, but in essence, you're hearing the same message over and over again, so it's really difficult for you to think about how you want to cover this message because it's one you've heard incessantly. So that's why it's good, I think, to rotate these people in and out so they actually at least are able to get some difference, hear a different message once in a while.
Well, they're also trying to find something new out of those stump speeches.
Correct.
And does that lead to getting maybe putting the magnifying glass too closely on certain things and playing up certain issues that maybe another reporter wouldn't play up if they had only been there a couple of days and hadn't heard the same stump speech over and over and over.
Exactly. And I think what happens also is that a lot of when I talk about this PAC journalism, you have a lot of political reporters moving in these PACs. It's sort of like being here at the University of Illinois during freshman orientation. You know, you've got all these people kind of moving together. I better go here because I don't want to miss out on this. I better go here because I don't want to miss out on that. So you have 20 or 30 freshmen going different places on campus.
And you see where the group is going.
Right, and you follow that. But veteran reporters, these experienced reporters, you know, we may think that they're all-knowing and omniscient and all that, but essentially they're just as panicked about getting lost or missing something as those freshmen are during orientation. They're just as panicked about not getting something that some other reporter is going to get. So they spend, as I said, a lot of time talking to one another and trading stories and whatever. And I think that's why you see today this amazing consistency. I see it mostly on broadcast. You see people on television, for example, on these talk shows, beginning to pick up the same verbiage, the same lines. You know, remember a long time, it was when Bush was running, it was gravitas, you know. That's what Cheney brings Bush, this gravitas that he needed.
Right.
So you see it over and over again, and they all pick up on the same word, and they just repeat it incessantly to the point where it's almost absurd and it loses its meaning, you know. But that's how desperate they are for something new and original.
So in that – with that worry in mind, I mean, they also have large organizations will have people who are not necessarily following the campaigns. They're following issues. They're talking to people out in – you know, ordinary people, I guess. I'm guessing by the time the election is over, maybe everybody in the entire country will have been interviewed once or twice by a reporter on subjects, especially in key battleground states. We think so. With the number of media outlets out there, what is there left to cover? Are people waiting for well, something else to happen, well, the next new thing.
One of the things we have to get past is the horse race. I mean, okay, that's got to be covered. We're always going to cover the horse race. We talk about that aspect of the presidential campaign. Who's ahead in what poll? Who's leading in this state, et cetera, et cetera. But I also believe there's another problem here, and I believe that some political reporters become addicted to the game of politics, and it's to them it's an inside baseball kind of a thing, and they just get caught up in it and don't think about the larger picture. I mean, they write about who is going to win rather than maybe who should win, you know, and that's a harder thing to write about, who should win or what will be the elements that create a winning campaign, what's going to put this person into office. And
so who monitors that? How does an editor, somebody who is above these reporters, come in and say, back off on that or try this perspective?
Well, normally, that's part of the vetting process in professional newsrooms. You've got editors who look at the stuff that's coming in from the reporters and they say, well, wait a minute, did you check this out or what about that? Producers should be doing the same thing. You know, there's a very famous quote from a Chicago editor during the Civil War. His correspondent in the field was lamenting the fact that there was nothing happening. And the editor said to him, wired him back with a cable or whatever, and said, when there's no news, send rumors, you know. And I think that's what's happens a lot in this in the campaign. People are desperate, especially when you've got a 24/7 news cycle that never stops. It's a huge monster, has to be fed continually. Mm-hmm. So people are shoveling whatever they can into the mouth of this giant creature, hoping to keep it fed. And the result is a lot of spurious information.
We'd like to hear you on your comments on the election cycle and the way it's being covered in popular media and the blogosphere and just about everywhere else. Ron Yates is our guest. He is the dean of the College of Media at the U of I. And your phone calls are welcome, 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Let's take a call now in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Hello?
Hello, Champaign. Yes, you're on.
Yes. I was just curious what Dean Yates thinks about one particular issue. I was reading the USA Today last week, and they've been repeatedly covering the so-called race issue. And I believe it was last week that they had one particular article in which essentially the article was an interview with Dick Armey, the well-known Republican. And the title was essentially America Not Ready for a Black President. And I know you were talking a moment ago about insider politics, but my sense was the very topic, you know, the notion that America may not be ready for a black president is providing a mouthpiece for this man. And it was very disturbing for me, at least. And many of the race-related articles, I have to wonder, based upon what, is it concern over the national condition of politics or actually something else might be going on? I'm curious your view about that.
Well, let me ask you a question. I don't recall, I didn't read that article, so I can't really speak to it specifically. However, I would ask you this. When you were reading that, do you know if the reporter or the article talked to anybody else about answering that question besides Armey?
I don't think they asked anybody else, frankly.
Well, was it an op-ed piece? Was it in the opinion section?
It was a regular news piece, and it was in the front of the USA Today online.
Well, I mean, if that's the case, then they violated a very basic tenet of journalism, professional journalism, that is you don't ever go with a one-source story. I mean, if you're going to write a story like that, you want to provide some context for it or certainly provide, talk to people on both sides of that equation. That's what we call balance, you know, and you're trying to achieve some form of balance. You cannot accept what one person says to be fact or the truth. You have to seek out other opinions. And so if you're going to do a piece like that, I would assume that you, if I had been the editor, I would never have run it unless there had been something to offset. The idea is not to disprove what Armey says. He may have that's his opinion. He can certainly say that. But you want to provide more context for something like that. You want to provide the idea of journalism really, and I said this, I've said it many times, journalism, I think, and I suspect, specifically talk about newspapers when I say this now, is really a nation talking to itself. And I think what you want to do is stimulate conversation in a way that makes some of these issues understandable and relevant rather than, gee, did you hear what this guy said? And it's really stupid. Why would he say something like that? Well, the question why they said something like that was because there was nobody there challenging them. And I think that's what you try to do as a journalist. You try to challenge some of these viewpoints.
Great. Thank you very much.
Sure. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your call. And one thing that has gotten criticism in the past is how reporters interpret balance when they put stories together.
Mm-hmm.
Do you necessarily have two people, he said, she said? How do you put together a decent balance and not just, you know, weighting one person's comments with another person's comments and calling that balance? How do you flesh out an actual real balance?
Well, it's difficult, but it's one of the fundamental journalistic rituals. Balance is a fundamental journalistic ritual. Journalists do not report what one person purports to be the truth, however compelling that truth may seem. The idea is you gather varying opinions about that topic, and then, for example, there used to be this amazing sign in the City News Bureau in Chicago, which was a great training ground for journalists, doesn't exist anymore. There was a sign over the door when you left, and it said, "If your mother says she loves you, check it out."
I love that phrase.
So when it comes to reporting their mother's love, journalists, they can quote the views of others who agree or disagree. I don't think your mother does love you. Well, maybe she does. I don't know. In this way, you really learn the status of the impartial observer, and that's what you're trying to accomplish in this business.
Let's go to a caller this afternoon on line two in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Thank you. Well, I think too often they just try to balance things out by asking the opinion of two different sides without analyzing, if there's an underlying truth to what either of them or one of them is saying is more true than the other. But admittedly, I'm a news and information junkie and probably spend a lot more time than the average person trying to find things out. But I just feel really ill-served by what I'll refer to as the mainstream media, and increasingly I'm starting to lump in PBS and NPR into that category, even though they're somewhat better than the network commercial media. But when I compare what I see and hear there with what I see and hear on with Amy Goodman, Democracy Now!, and Laura Flanders and her program, people she gets on to analyze what's going on, not only in the campaigns but otherwhere, news generally. I'm quite thoroughly disappointed in what passes for discourse in this country. If you had that kind of analysis represented in even 10% of what gets on in the mainstream media, I think we'd have a very different political reality in this country today.
Could I ask you a question?
Sure.
If you're disenchanted with the mainstream media, where are you getting your news then?
Well, as I said, I watch Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. Juan Gonzalez is on there a lot of times too,
mm-hmm.
on free speech television.
Mm-hmm.
You can also get it on WFT if you want to listen to it on the radio.
I think you bring up a good point. I think one of the problems we have today is there's such a plethora of outlets there. I mean, go back 30 years, which I can do very easily, which probably tells you how old I am. But anyway, you can go back 30 years or so, and there, you had ABC, NBC, CBS, that was it. And then you had big newspapers, and you had the wire services and a few magazines. That was where we got our information, And so a lot of the I have an opportunity, to talk to people like Walter Cronkite, and when they're very, very upset with the way especially television is doing its job these days. As a matter of fact, just a couple of two or three weeks ago, there was a gathering at the National Press Club in Washington of several what we call old-timers, you might say, Hal Bruno being one of them, a former ABC News political director and former Newsweek correspondent, who is our alumna. And alumnus, I should say, and there were five others there, and they were discussing coverage today, and they were really upset with it. And one of the things that Hal pointed out, he said, you can hardly believe his eyes as he views this brave new world of 24/7 political coverage. You've got television networks airing unconfirmed rumors just because they appeared on a website someplace or some blog. You got anchors spouting opinions from the anchor desk when they shouldn't be doing that. You've got veteran politicos masquerading as on-air analysts spewing their ideological viewpoints and partisan talking points. And, you know, he called them, you know, what he calls them are pretend journalists. I might call them pseudo-journalists, people who use this revolving door from politics into journalism without any training, and they have little or no sense of journalism ethics or professionalism. And believe me, having been in that business for 25 years, I know there's professionalism in it. Not everybody perhaps adheres to it the same way, but it's very deep rooted in newsrooms. But going, you know, to one of the points you mentioned, journalists must recognize that raw facts are not enough. What you said is entirely true. You're looking at a gubernatorial race, for example, and you say that Jones says his plans are going to lower state income taxes by $200 a person. But what if Jones simply fabricated this figure? So, you know, and his plan would actually raise taxes. So what truth does the journalist convey by reporting exactly what Jones said? None. What you need to do is go deeper than that and go and find out what actually is behind what Jones said and find out what the other side is.
Well, that's why I go to commondreams.org to, you know, gather analysis there, why, you know, you go to publications like In These Times and, you know, other sources so that you don't just take, you know, corporate media opinion, which, you know, I mean, when you look at the way Fox and Hannity, you know, on their interviewed Governor Palin, you know, I mean, it's just laughable that that's considered to be journalism.
It's all in the eye of the beholder, I guess.
Well, thanks for your call. And I mean, there is a point there that the definition of journalist these days has broadened out so much that there are, you know, people who may not, you know, subscribe to the same standards of fairness and balance that are calling themselves journalists, and their media operations are portraying them as journalists or anchors or what have you.
Yeah, but I worry really about people getting information on the internet that is really, if you look at it, and I've done this, I've actually followed one thread through various websites and through the blogosphere, and what I see is this one thread being rebroadcast and rehashed over and over and over again, even though the thread is completely invalid, that it's completely spurious and inaccurate. And by the time it gets to about the fifth or sixth level, it's been enhanced, added to, expanded, and turned into something that it really never was. And this is a huge danger. And people look at this stuff and see it as truth, and because there's absolutely zero vetting on the blogosphere, none to speak of. And I think you've got to, that's one thing that professional news organizations, love them or hate them, that's one thing that they do and they take very seriously. As I said, having been in that world, I know how seriously we take it.
All right, let's go to line one and a caller in Champaign again. Good afternoon.
Hi. I agree totally with the man that just called, and I have some other points to make. I listen to Democracy Now! Also. You have to learn how to be an intelligent listener. The corporations have been in control of your main news companies. I'm liking what Keith Olbermann's doing because he's going after some of the hypocrisy. Part of the problem is that they try to do these programs on the cheap, and then they don't pay for investigative journalism. A lot of that's been lost. Network neutrality is important, and that's something we need to support. So that's my statement.
All right. Well, thanks for your call.
Mm-hmm.
Any comment on that? And let me ask about your opinion of Keith Olbermann, for example, who's been in sports journalism for a while and has now leapt over to news and is not averse to giving his opinion.
He's not a journalist. I mean, he's a commentator. You have to look at him that way. Keith Olbermann is not a journalist. He never pretended to be. That's not his background. He is a talking head. He says what he feels is his opinion. Same thing a lot with Chris Matthews. Same thing with Bill O'Reilly on Fox. Same thing with Hannity and Combs. These are not journalists. These are people who present their views. And the problem is the viewing public often doesn't separate that from what we consider to be real professional journalism, and that's just not what those people are. And if they may be saying things which have an element of truth in them, but these are their opinions.
What happens when they they wind up anchoring election coverage like Keith Olbermann and Chris Matthews did this summer.
Right, a big danger, isn't it? And what happened? They pulled them off of that because obviously they were perceived as being pretty biased, you know, and that they weren't they pulled off of that coverage? Yeah. So I think if you're going to be honest with your viewing public or your listening or reading public, you must try your best to achieve some form of balance. I know, obviously, objectivity is impossible. There's no such thing because even if you were to create some big computer and make it an objective news gatherer, presenter, whatever, it would take the subjective hand to put in the software. So no matter what happens, there is no such thing as objectivity, but you just try to achieve some balance. And that's what we're after.
We're talking about election coverage with U of I College of Media Dean Ron Yates. And let's go to a call on line 3 in Champaign. Good afternoon. Hello, line 3. Are you with us? Evidently not. So barring that, we will go to line 2. Line 2 in Champaign County. Good afternoon. We seem to have a problem. Do we have somebody on line 3? First of all, let's go to line 3.
Hello?
Line 3. Line 3, good afternoon.
Hello?
Yes, hello. Line 3, you are on.
Okay. Actually, to take a little intermission here from, the race, political, I don't think, from what I can see, is that the coverage in terms of this meltdown on Wall Street and in terms of this, buyout or whatever they're proposing, the $700 billion, I don't see a lot of discussion. I mean, yeah, we do get something from Congress, I guess, back and forth. But what does it really mean? You know, the other one is that, we talk about a democracy and, we're talking about capitalism. So, what's wrong? What's going on? You know, that kind of thing. So I don't know what your reaction to that or not.
Well, that's a good let me throw something out at you. There was yesterday or the day before yesterday, CNN poll. And, they're talking about the issues. What are the issues in this campaign and how are they ranked? And here's how they were ranked. And this was, I think, before the $700 billion bailout was announced. The number one issue in this campaign right now, according to these people, 56% of them said it's the economy. And 13% said it was the war in Iraq. 12% said health care. 11% said terrorism, 6% illegal immigration, 1% other, and another 1% was unsure. So obviously, the economy is the number one issue. So if you're a reporter and you're covering this campaign, I think because that's the number one issue, that is an area that you want to keep focusing on and you want to keep hammering the candidates on. What are their plans? How are they going to make this work? What are they going to do if they get into office? How are they going to change what needs to be changed and whatever? And how are they going to get their hands how are they going to get the Congress, which is always at odds, never able to work together on anything, it seems, to do something together that will solve this problem, which is really critical. I mean, this thing, if this goes any further, could absolutely have a detrimental impact on the entire global economy and bring the whole world into some kind of a very deep recession, if not depression.
Yeah, but I mean, the point is that what they're doing is they're pressing for, it sounds like sort of like the Iraq war, in a way, the big push and not a lot of discussion. But I mean, I think this is a real time that, that some real discussion ought to take part, and rather than run into something, and then what happens, you find that doesn't work, and all of a sudden they're coming back and for more and more money. So, I think that it just is not covered very well in terms of depth. And certainly if you go on, the evening programs and the whole bit, they just talk about this part and, a couple whatever, and that's about it. But,
well, a lot of it has to do with the viewers and listeners and readers. People, ultimately it's up to them. News organizations put out a lot of information. I would challenge anybody. I could sit down with the New York Times, the Chicago Tribune, major newspapers, and go through them from cover to cover. And the amount of information contained in those newspapers is absolutely astounding on a daily basis. However, how many American readers actually read everything in those papers? They don't. How many readers or listeners actually listen to everything that's said about the economy or whatever on NPR or other radio stations? And there aren't many out there because most other radio stations don't do news or on television. It's up to the public, really, to spend the time and effort to understand these issues, and all the media can do is present them in some compelling way that makes them very complex issues understandable. But ultimately, it's up to the viewer and listener.
All right. Thanks for your call. Apparently, we've lost line three. But that's where some of these aggregator-type sites come in that we've noticed as the Internet matures, there are these sites that different people can go to and look at news that's been selected by other people specifically for those people, whether it's aimed toward technology, whether it's aimed toward any other subject, whether it's aimed toward some sort of ideology or other. That's both a benefit and a hazard, I guess.
It is. You know, I really believe coverage of the campaign needs to focus on bringing new knowledge. Reporters need to be bringing new knowledge to the coverage, not just the same, horse race stuff. It needs to really look. And what the caller was saying, I understand what he's saying, that there may be some frustration that somehow this isn't being discussed enough. But I believe it's out there. It really is. Mm-hmm. But most people don't want to take the time or don't have the time to look at it and understand it.
Our numbers again, 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455. Your questions and comments are welcome for Ron Yates. We will go first to line four, then line two – or line one, rather, four, then one, then two. So let's start with line four. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. And I really agree with you about the horse race coverage thing. That somebody told me once or mentioned, said that's just – kind of lazy journalism to just get bogged down talking about that all the time.
You're right.
But I want to go back to the Sunday morning talk shows on TV. I tuned in and was watching them all for the most part, kind of channel surfing back and forth, and Henry Paulson was making the rounds, and I spent, I guess, probably an hour and a half or so watching them. And at the end of it, I had absolutely no idea that part of the proposal was that the Treasury Secretary could not be questioned about it, could not be, there was no recourse, that he was calling all the shots, and the law, the court of law could not review what he had done. I sat there and I watched an hour and a half of coverage on it, and he was being interviewed by all these journalists, and that never came up as far as I could tell. And it was later in the afternoon, I think, that I heard it on NPR. Cokie Roberts came on Monday morning, and her encapsulated view of it was, take the money and go away. That was the way she referred to it, and so it was about, 5 seconds. But that was a major piece of this legislation or this proposal.
Well, I think like a lot of folks, even the media at this point, because this was such a surprise that the fact that suddenly there's $700 billion being put on the table here to bail out Wall Street. I think a lot of folks, even in the media, were having trouble figuring out what this all meant. And, you've got to understand something fairly well to be able to ask intelligent questions about it, which is one of the reasons I think when you have, rookie reporters out there covering candidates, they can get snowed by these candidates because they don't have the depth of knowledge that people, like I mentioned before, Hal Bruno and some of these other people have. They've been around the block. Hal Bruno covered 50 years of campaigns, and he's covered all these, campaigns, the presidential campaigns, the conventions and whatever. You can't snow a guy like that, but even Hal, as smart as he is, he would have to sit down and spend a day or two going through all these documents trying to figure out what this $700 billion bailout means and what kinds of questions he wants to ask Obama and McCain. And that's what's missing, I think, right now. And how do you do that in a half-hour show? How do you do it in a one-hour meet-the-press format? You can't do it. These are very complex things. You just cannot get to the heart of anything in that way. And one of the things Walter Cronkite told me, and he says it often, is that the broadcast world just can't do what you can do in a newspaper. And I know that newspapers are changing and they're looking different and they're going online and all that. But the fact is they can write something in 3,000 or 4,000 words. That's a hefty story. But by the time you finish it, you're going to have an understanding of it. And Nick, you can't do that on broadcast. That takes a 2-hour documentary of some kind.
Well, thanks for calling in. And since we've lost our communication with Master Control, I'll just go right down the line, 1, 2, 3, and 4. So let's go next to line 1. Good afternoon.
Hi. A lot of interesting points. I like the idea of the caller earlier talking about the going to alternative press, which gets dismissed as advocacy and not professional quite a bit, and I think that there's a problem there. But on this last point that you were just making, I think the previous caller would share my assessment that the Paulson proposal was 2.5 pages long. That's shorter than the article you just cited. So there was no reason that in a half-hour show they might have gone to Section 8, which is the one that actually says that there is no recourse at all.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think I agree it's a complicated situation, and credit default swaps weren't being talked about until just recently, and we don't even know how many trillions of dollars are represented in that, et cetera, et cetera. But their proposal was 2.5 pages long. There is no reason in a half-hour show that they couldn't have said, Are you running for czar here or what? But they don't have the temerity to do that. Now, I actually called in earlier and I got dumped somehow. Maybe it was my fault. But
I think we've had a couple of phone problems this afternoon.
I wanted to and you did bring up, the host actually brought up this two-sidism idea that now we on this economic issue we have three sides inside of each party. And it makes it for a harder story for anybody to cover, obviously. But most complicated issues can't be reduced to anything like two sides. There's a comment there. But what I really wanted, what prompted me to call, was this Charlie Gibson interview with Sarah Palin, and the fact that people were dumping on him for being arrogant, and perhaps he was a bit, about the Bush doctrine and saying, which doctrine, how many doctrines does Bush have? Well, he made it clear that he was talking about preemptive strike without imminent threat. And he never, the problem I had with him was he never got to really nail her down on that, because she responded with talking about, well, if there's an imminent threat, So the idea that this government can, this country, this nation, this army, whatever, this president can attack a country on the idea that there's a threat down the line, the fact that he fumbled it so badly is we never actually got her to say whether she thought it was reasonable or not. And, it was a feint.
Well, I think one of the things you have to look at there is what is McCain's position, and his position is not the same, I don't think, as Bush's in that regard. So I would assume she would follow McCain's lead on that.
Well, he did back the preemptive strike without an imminent threat. I mean, he bought, and now people are going to say, well, they all thought that it was, but we know that it lied, and we have the Habash letter, which was produced in England, which was a total fabrication, and then we have so many of these total fabrications to deal with, and people don't know what I'm talking about now because we don't have a press that actually confronts that kind of malfeasance in high places, it seems to me. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for your call. Let's move on to line 2. Line 2, good afternoon.
Hi.
Hello.
Before I ask your guest what blogs does he read on a daily basis, if he really wants to find something about the news, where does he go on a daily basis? I'll list my three, and he can comment on those if he wants. I always like to read Think Progress. I always like to read The Raw Story. And I also look at The Washington Note. Which ones does he look at? I'm not talking about newspaper websites. I'm talking about political blogs.
I look at different ones. Political.com is one I liked a lot because I know the people who write for that and work there.
That's one of mine also, yes.
Right. I think they're pretty good.
Is Political considered a blog?
Well, it's considered.
They have actual reporters that work for that.
They actually do, but they do blog.
Yeah.
And those reporters blog. And I look at, individual blogs from different reporters that I've gotten to know who work for the mainstream media. They have their own blogs, and there may be people who are covering my area of interest, because I was a foreign correspondent, is international coverage and how people cover places like China and Japan, where I used to work. So I look at those kinds of blogs, and then I sometimes some of these blogs I maybe only go to once or twice, and I just kind of surf right through them. But there are many that look at, for example. There's one, I think there's one called The Choice, I think is one that I've seen a few times around, and a couple of others. But they're, I look at these blogs because they, if there's something happening in a particular part of the world, what I found really fascinating is if you've got something happening in a, you know, a disaster or perhaps a war or something happening in a particular part of the world, the people who live in that country are online a lot talking about what's going on. And I'm really fascinated by that because that's access to information that I, you know, you wouldn't normally have. Now, once again, you have to be very careful about the accuracy of that information, but it's really interesting to be able to go to these sites and see what people are writing about what's happening in their own backyard.
My last comment is that obviously more and more people are looking for alternative press out there on the internet, especially people, I'll say, under 35. Mm-hmm. And some of us that are well over 55 are also looking for more of the news online than they're getting out of mainstream media.
Yeah, and I think what you're also seeing is, you know, mainstream media doing a lot more of that also. But I think it's a you know, it's obviously a sea change, and it's having a, an enormous impact on the financials, the business plans and business operations of what we call mainstream media, the traditional media. But I believe that what's going to happen is eventually there'll be a huge shakeout, and the blogs that are really good and the ones that are proven to be accurate consistently are the ones that are going to survive, and the others will go away.
Thank you.
And thanks for your call this afternoon. Let's move to line three with a couple of minutes left. Good afternoon.
Hi. My name is Joe, and I was just calling. I had a couple of comments. You know, he was talking a little bit earlier about coverage, and, you know, you can't do much in a half hour or whatever. But it seems like a lot of the news is just fluff pieces, and nobody it's entertainment now. It's not news, it's entertainment, and it's dependent upon the, you know, what will the advertisers allow? What will the corporate head allow?
Well, I don't know. Okay, I understand what you're saying, and I agree with you. I think what we have, what I like to use, the word infotainment, because what they've done is they've blended news with entertainment in some way and created something that makes it a little more, you know, jazzy, a little more sexy or whatever, and therefore has a larger audience. You know, you're going to tune into some TV show where you've got people sitting around a table yelling at one another, and it becomes entertainment. And the news factor or the information part of that is really minimal, but it's the entertainment value of these people who are otherwise seem to be intelligent human beings behaving badly, like they were in a bar someplace, you know, and yelling at one another. But I think that's one area. And
And then you also take news. And, you know, a regular news program, or maybe the local news, especially, I think is worse at it. This will give you cancer. Tune in at 9.
Right.
To see what you.
Well,
need.
You know, it's often phrased as a question.
Right.
They're
right.
Posing the question, but right. but the way the reason, you know, just posing the question makes one think. Well, maybe it does.
I like to talk about something I call, and I've said it before, but I think I said it yesterday on another show here that I was doing. I like to talk about what I call spinach journalism. This is journalism which says, here, it's sort of like when your mother put that plate of spinach in front of you, or eat this, it's good for you. You know, here, read this, look at it, listen to it, it's good for you. You need to know this, you know, and that's what I think is missing so much today, because people, news organizations are trying to give people what they want instead of what they need.
Yeah, or giving people their slant as opposed to, I mean, I realize you can't tell a story without putting your slant on it, but I think it goes too far.
Well, I think you can tell a story without putting your slant on it, but I want to go back to what I said before. There is no such thing as 100% objectivity. There's always going to be some subjective element to anything that any journalist does. But what we try to do is not to slant something or spin it a certain way. You try to be as fair and balanced as you possibly can.
Well, some people do, I suppose. I don't know. It doesn't seem like when you get these staunch Republicans who like to go at people like attack dogs on television and hounding upon every little bitty, you know, you have a little mistake that is made. I can't think of some of the things.
But that happens on both sides of the equation. You have the daily costs. You've got the daily costs. You've got, a couple of other stations, people that – it depends on your political spectrum. I mean, if you're a liberal, you're going to attack conservatives. Conservatives attack liberals. That's how it works.
Yes, but you don't have that many liberals in the news media anymore.
Really? I'm not sure about that.
All the ones that I see seem to be you see the ones on CNN and you see the ones on Fox. Where are the liberals there?
On CNN, most people think CNN is a pretty liberal cable news network. I mean, most people think that, at least. I think if you were to do a poll, that's what people would say. But, once again, it's an eye of the beholder. But the New York Times, what's that?
I don't watch a lot of Fox or CNN. So I guess I see some of the guys, especially on Fox.
Well, you know what we tend to do is
let me say thanks for your call because we will have to wrap up in the next 30 seconds or so.
Okay.
But your final comments on that call.
Well, I think people have to. I think people, what they normally do is seek something that validates their own views. So if you're a conservative, you go to conservative websites or programs. So those, it validates what you believe. And if you're a liberal, you do the same thing. And I think what's wrong is people need to go the other way. Conservatives need to see what liberals are hearing. Liberals need to see what conservatives are hearing. And that may you're going to get something from the other side. So it's up to the responsibility of the consumer, news consumer, to do that.
One final thing that I'd like to bring up, just what sites are trying to do those kinds of things. Give me your opinion, first of all, something like a factcheck.org where it seems like their reason to exist is to try to counter some of the things that get thrown back and forth in a campaign.
That's certainly one, and I think it's a tough job because no matter how they do it, they're probably going to be criticized for leaving something out. There's always going to be the sin of omission, Well, why didn't you put this in, or why wasn't that part of it, No matter what you do, you're going to get criticism. And, of course, that's, journalists are used to that. We have pretty thick skins.
The struggle continues.
Absolutely.
Ron Yates is the Dean of the College of Media at the University of Illinois. And we bring him in every now and then to talk about the field of journalism. And we look forward to having you in again one of these days.
Be happy to come back.
Thanks, Ron. It is 7 minutes before 2 o'clock, and settlement prices are now in from the CME Group with those numbers. AM 580's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much. Let's take a look at the numbers in Chicago as they finish, Tom, on a Wednesday afternoon. December wheat futures today, a 7.50. Let's see, where did that settle? I've just got the wrong screen. There it is, 7.30 and a quarter, down 20 and a quarter on the day. A 7.60 top, bottom at 23 and a quarter. Settlement price at 7.30 and a quarter, down 20 and one quarter. March contract, 7.79 and three quarters. The high, the low at 44. Settlement price at $7.50 and three quarters, 19 and a half cents lower in the May contract. In the wheat pit, $7.89, the high, the low at 58 and a quarter. Settlement price at $7.65, down 18 and a half. July futures, 8.03 and a half, the high, the low at 7.68 and a quarter. Settlement price at $7.76 and a quarter, down 19 and three quarters. In September wheat futures next year, 8.17 and three quarters, the high, the low at 7.86. The 09 contract for the SEP at 7.92 and a quarter, down 20 and one quarter. December Minneapolis grain exchange wheat settled 14 and three quarters lower at $7.96 and a half. And the hard red winter wheat in Kansas City settled at $7.59, 22 and a half cents lower. From the corn pit in Chicago, green across that pit today, up 2 3/4 of a cent in a nearby December contract. $5.74 the high, the low at $5.55. Settlement price $5.63, up 2 3/4 for December corn. March contract $5.91 3/4 the high, the low at $7.72 3/4. Settlement price at $5.80 1/2, up 2 1/2 cents. In the May future, $6.01 the high, the low at $5.85 1/2. Settled at 5.92 and a quarter, up 3. July futures, 6.10, the high, the low at 5.94 and three quarters. Settlement for the July 09 corn contract, up 2 3/4. In September futures, 6.10 and a half, the high, the low at 5.96. Settlement price, 3 cents higher, 6.02 and three quarters. December next year, 6.10 and a half, the high. The low at 5.95. December 2009 corn settled at $6.02¾, 4 cents a bushel higher. December oat futures, 3.49 and a half, the high. The low at 3.34. Settlement price at 3.34 on the low, down 9 cents. And the March contract, 3.65 and a half, the high. The low at 54. Settlement price at 51 and a half, down 8 and a half cents on the afternoon. Now the soy complex, nearby November beans, $12.08 the high. Low at 11.78¼. Settlement price at 11.87, unchanged. January futures unchanged as well. $12.24 and a half the high. The low at 11.94¾. Settlement price at $12.03¾, unchanged for the January soybean futures. March contract 12.38 the high. The low at $12.09. A settlement at 12.17 and a half, 0.75 cents lower. July futures were down 0.75 cents as well. 12.49 the high. The low at 12.20 and a quarter. July soybeans settled $12.29 and a half, down 0.75 cents. August contract 12.38 and a half, the settlement price a half cent higher. September's at 12.27, settlement price up 3. And next year's November will give you the high, the low, and the settlement 12.14 and 3 quarters, 11.91 and a half. And a settlement price at $12.04 for the November soybeans of next year, 8 cents the gain on the day. October bean meal, 331, the high, the low at 322.90. Settlement price at 327.60, up to 30. December bean meal futures, 336.20, the high, the low at 327.80. Settlement price at 332.50, up to 50. October bean oil, 48.55, the high, the low at 47.49. Settlement price at 47.70, down 4 cents, and December futures finished 3 cents lower at 48.20. During the closing market report this afternoon, which is just 9 minutes away now, we'll talk with Naomi Jacobson. She's a 103rd District Representative here in Urbana, a Democrat, and is participating in the Eastern Illinois Food Bank and Food Bank $25 challenge. Will take up food security and food insecurity with her. Paul Cooley will be along, of course, to take up the agricultural markets. And in the second half hour, we'll call it our Harvest Hour edition of the Closing Market Report, Gary Schnitke with the Farm Doc team right here on campus will join us to take up the cost of producing corn and soybeans. That all happens on the Closing Market Report.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
The numbers in Chicago from the CME Group's livestock side for the Mercantile Exchange. October contract and the nearby live cattle futures, 25, or rather 2.5 cents the loss. 102.35 the high, the low at 101.80. Settlement price at 102.17 and a half, 2.5 lower. December futures, 104.25 the high, the low at 103.60. Settled 104.20, 75 cents higher. February futures, 104.55 for the live cattle. The low at 104, settlement price at 104.32 and a half, 65 cents higher. And the April live cattle futures had a high today of 105.20, a low at 104.55, settled at 105.15, 92 and a half cents higher. September feeder cattle, 107.75, the high, the low at 107.57 and a half, a settlement price at 107.70, a dime higher. October futures, 107.75, the high, the low at 106.30. Settled at 107.60, up a dollar in November, 107.50, the high, the low at 105.55. Settlement price at 107.45, a dollar 50 higher. January futures in feeder cattle, 107.20, the high, the low at 105.20. Settlement price at 107.75, a dollar 22.5 higher. And the October lean hog futures, 69.15, the high, the low at 68.55. Settlement price 68.95, up 50 cents. December futures, 66.75, the high, the low at 65.95. Settlement price at 66.22.5, down 7.5 cents. And the February lean hog futures, 72.60, the high, the low at 71.90, settled at 72.27 and a half, up 40 cents. April futures, 77.22 and a half, the high, the low at 76.80. Settlement price there for the April lean hog futures, $77.12 and a half, up 12 and a half cents. The outside markets at this hour are trading the nearby November crude oil futures at $105.70. They're down 91 cents a barrel, but the December futures have gained $1.68 at $107.15. Ethanol at $2.26 and a half is 3 cents higher. Natural gas at $7.69 is down 23 cents, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average now stands at 10,901, just about 48 points lower for the afternoon. It's the top of the hour, straight up, 2 o'clock Central. You're listening.